Ladies, gentlemen, and Patrick, welcome to the Effing Bag Show on Friday. You can see Courtney, the lovely Ali, myself, and Dave, and our fantastic guest, Matt Letitia. And Dave's going to fangirl out with his pants, so Dave's going to ask the first question.
So everybody's had their fan, and so we said that the beginning that basically, for me, and I put it out there on the show, that for me the greatest English football player of all time, bar none, for me, and that still sticks. And I just want to know from yourself, how disappointed was you that you never got more England caps? Because it baffles me still to this day that. And I know we shouldn't mention names, but people like Colton Palmer were being playing in midfield, and people like yourself that were probably, even them days, still better than the likes of the players that were in that England side, and you never seemed to get in this side.
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the biggest disappointments, I think, of my career, really. I felt like I should have had a bit more of an opportunity to show what I could do at international level. You know, I only started three games. One of them was abandoned after 27 minutes because of crowd trouble. And the other two games were, I think they were 3 years apart. So it's not really much of an opportunity to show what you can do at international level. You know, I probably didn't do myself any favours in terms of staying at Southampton, probably hindered me in terms of the international football, especially as two of the clubs that I turned down during my career were Spurs when Terry Venables was manager, who then went on to become England manager, and I turned down Chelsea in 1995 when Glenn Hoddle was Chelsea manager, and then he went on to become the next England manager as well. So, probably not my two best decisions I could have made in terms of my international career, but at the same time, I think you also have to understand and respect that in the mid-90s, there was a lot more English talent available to pick from, I think, around that time. You know, nowadays, if you had an English midfielder scoring 20 goals a season, he would probably be pretty much guaranteed not only a place in the squad, but a place in the starting lineup and the team built around him. However, when I was doing that in the mid-90s, I was still struggling to get in the squad. And that's because there were some fantastic footballers around at that time. But I still maintain that even with all those fantastic footballers around, I thought that I was worthier of just a handful of starts for my country.
I mean, we've seen that the show that you've done as well, where you've gone with the sort of the England legends as well, and you've gone to play Germany a couple of times, and et cetera, et cetera. And then also we've seen you on Soccer Saturday. You seem to have a massive friendship with Paul Merson, and it seems to work really well, sort of on camera and also on the pitch as well. And I mean, I've seen some of the Saturday specials, Christmas specials, when you did the five sides and all that sort of stuff. And I think you're unbeaten at those as well, if I remember rightly. So, I mean, yeah. Have you never ever thought about going into management itself?
I not really, I think, is the answer to that. I did offer in 2005 or 2006, might have been, when Harry left Southampton. We'd been relegated to the Championship, and then we hadn't really done very well in the Championship. And I think when Harry left, we were kind of bottom half of the Championship. And at that point, I kind of thought, well, you know, if I could do something to help the club, you know, it's not like we could get any worse. Little did I know that it did get worse. And we eventually went down another league. But it wasn't out of a sense of me wanting to become a manager. I only offered because that was out of a sense of me wanting to help the football club, you know, and felt like I could perhaps try and do something to galvanise the club again, because it was just starting to feel a little bit fractured. And unfortunately, it became that way for quite a few years before we returned to the top flight.
And is your friendship with Paul as strong as it looks on screen?
Do you know what? Me and Merce have known each other a heck of a long time. You know, we're pretty much the same age. There's about 6 months between us. So our careers have pretty much, you know, been parallel to each other. And so obviously I knew him from England, you know, having played against him for many, many years and having so much respect for the amount of ability that he had on a football pitch. I mean, he was one of the most talented players in the Premier League. You know, absolute fruitcake. You know, mad as a box of frogs. and obviously, you know, has his issues. You know, like a lot of people do, that he's fighting demons his whole life. And so if I was able to help him in any way to try and do that, then I was always going to be there for him, you know. And obviously the Harry's Hero stuff, we spent a lot of time together. But since I left the job, and because of the situation at the moment with the world the way it is, we haven't actually spent much time together. I think we had dinner together just before last Christmas, I think it was. So it was kind of beginning of December, I think, something like that. And yeah, that was the last time I actually saw him in the flesh, but we've spoken on the phone since.
Harry's Heroes was fantastic. It was a really, really good watch. And I've seen Merce, obviously, like you, at Sportsman's Dinner, but I've seen him at two or three. And I just really hope, like, I hope he's still doing really well with his recovery, because he told some stories at Sportsman's Dinner and the whole place was belly laughing. And I was sitting there and I could have just cried into my hands, because I was like, this is really sad. This is someone's life that everyone's like wetting themselves laughing at. But you know what it's like with those things. Everyone's like beard off, boozed off, and they were like, oh, Mercer's so funny. And I was sitting there and I was like, this isn't funny at all. And I just wanted to go up and hug him. I was like, hey, it'll be okay.
No, he does have that effect on people, you know, when he tells his story, because he's so open and he's so honest about what he's been through, you know, and how tough it's been for him. And I think people, you know, really, when you do that, you know, and you open yourself up to your innermost feelings, you know, people have a lot of respect for you for doing that. So it seems at the moment that he's still on a good path. And that's great to hear.
Good. It's nice that he can have good friends around him like you, who he knows he can depend on, because it's easy to be led off your straight and narrow, isn't it?
Yeah, no, very much so. And I think probably in that first series of Harry's Heroes, if he didn't have somebody else who was pretty much, I mean, I'm not really a drinker, so alcohol don't really bother me at all. So it didn't make any difference to me. A lot of the other lads in the show like to go out and have a drink. And so it might have been really hard for Merce if he was the only one that didn't, you know. So I had no problem in, it didn't bother me one bit, you know, just keeping him company and just, you know, having romantic dinners for two in Paris and all that stuff.
I think, in all fairness, though, I mean, even that, in the second series there, you know, the sort of, I suppose, conversation between himself and Neil Ruddock in that second part was probably one of the most powerful pieces of TV I think I've seen in a very, very long time. And, you know, and I'd said to the girls before we started, you know, I suffer a little bit with the depression, not to the extent, of course, of what Paul does, but it was something really, really powerful. And I think it really did hit home, that sort of 10, 15 minutes of that part of the show was incredible.
Yeah, no, it absolutely was. And I know a lot of the time people, when they watch these shows, they kind of assume sometimes that these things are set up, and, you know, all stage managed. That was just a conversation that just propped up and just went in a direction that I don't think most people were guessing it would do. And yeah, it did. It was explosive, but it was from the heart. You know, it was what Merce felt and what he saw was happening to Neil. And he was trying to help him at the end of the day. And so, you know, if that helped anybody watching that show to actually, you know, wake up and realise what's happening in their lives, and you know, you have the power to do something about it, then all well and good. And I'm pleased that, you know, because it would have been easy for Merce to and Razor to have both gone, do you know what? Not really comfortable with that being shown in public, and they could easily have just gone, you've got to cut that bit out. But fair play to the pair of them. They both went, no, that was real. It's got it, you know, and we feel we can help people. And fair play to the pair of them.
Well, we just had one question come in for you, Matt. It's from Danny, and he's coming to say, how proud is Matt of Guernsey's rise up the non-league pyramid?
I think it's been a fantastic story, you know, and obviously very proud of my brother for being involved in it right from the start, in the organisation, the setup of the whole thing. You know, there was a small handful of them that got together and decided this is what they want to do. And the success that they've made of it in such a short space of time has been nothing short of incredible, really. And it's been fantastic to see. And it's just a shame that obviously what's happened in the world at the moment with the travel restrictions that they weren't able to play in the league this season. Hopefully, fingers crossed, next season they can get back to normal and start competing again at a very good level.
I got asked a question in the week, Matt, and it's a kind of a true or false question. Someone rang me and said, "Oh, ask Matt if it's true that his brother was in fact the better footballer."
Well, I've got three elder brothers now. Mark, who's obviously involved at Guernsey FC, is the only one of us that was a defender, so he didn't really get the limelight and the headlines very much, although he was quite decent. But my other two brothers, I've always described them as equally as talented as me, but without the mental fortitude that I had.
Oh, okay. Matt, they didn't have the up and go.
Yeah, no, they were both very, very talented footballers. I mean, my brother Kevin turned down a professional contract at Oxford at the age of 19 and decided to stay in Guernsey. And he played in the leagues in Guernsey from, you know, up until he was probably 36, 37, I think he was. And I think he averaged just over a goal a game in Guernsey football over the course of 20 years. So it was a pretty special goal scorer. And then my brother Carl was probably the top scoring midfielder in Guernsey football history as well. And he wasn't so much of a lethal finisher like Kevin was. He was more of a midfielder who would create a lot more and chip in with his goals as well. So Carl was probably more like me than Kevin, but I always tell them that I got the best of both their attributes.
And with regards to your England career, do you think that the two managers that you mentioned held a grudge because you didn't go to their team, or do you just think that you didn't fit their team at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the system that Terry Venables wanted to play, he probably felt that I couldn't fit into it for some reason. Although I think with Glenn Hoddle, I think there might have been a little bit of that I snubbed him when he was Chelsea manager, because my agent rang me in 95 and he said to me, "Look, Chelsea want to buy you." And I went, "No, I'm not interested. I'm happy where I am." And then 5 minutes later, he rang me back and he went, "Oh, I've told Chelsea, but Glenn Hoddle wants to speak to you." Because he wants to, you know, bear in mind, I was a Spurs fan and Glenn Hoddle was my hero as a kid. And he ran back and he went, "Well, Glenn Hoddle wants to speak to you, see if he can change your mind." And I was like, "Well, I've made my mind up already. I'm not going to change my mind, so I don't want to speak to him." You know, that was hard for me. That was my hero that I was just blanking, really. But I knew if I spoke to him, it would probably go all mushy on the phone. So I just decided not to speak to him.
And he has that effect on my mum as well, Matt. She loves Glenn Hoddle. If you can give me his number after this, she'll be buzzing, honestly. Best Mother's Day present ever, honestly.
You think I still talk to him?
I'll try again for next year then. Come on, Mum.
You press block on Matt's number, is that block? Reason in for staying at Southampton for the most of your career, obviously you said you had offers from other people, but why could they not sway you?
Well firstly I was never in football for money, first of all, so the fact that I was turning down a lot more money that could have been earning was irrelevant to me. I just wanted to play football the way I wanted to play it. You know, I loved entertaining people. I think that was one of the criticisms that I had during my career, is that people often accuse me of having a lack of ambition. And it kind of annoys me a little bit that's labelled at me, because as an 8-year-old kid growing up in Guernsey, where no footballer had ever played for England, and I had an ambition as an 8-year-old kid to not only be a professional footballer, but to play for England. You know, and that as a little kid in Guernsey where nobody had ever done that before, that's a pretty high ambition to set yourself. And I managed to do that. And so the whole lack of ambition thing kind of annoyed me a little bit. But I had, there were times at, at Southampton, I just felt like it was where I belonged. And I also felt a sense of loyalty to Southampton in that they were the team that gave me my chance to achieve my dreams, basically. And I've always felt like I owed something. And I don't think I could have lived with myself if I would have left Southampton and then they would have got relegated. I think that would have weighed really heavy on my mind. And that wasn't something that I was prepared to live with.
Do you think we'll get many more one club men now? I know they're kind of a dying breed in football, aren't they? For whatever reason that might be, but
money, I think, is the reason.
She's loosely directing this question to her own club.
How dare you? I would never throw Mark Noble's name out there for no apparent reason after his recent heartfelt announcement he may have made this week or may not have made. I may not have read it.
I saw that he made an announcement. I didn't get round to actually reading it. Was it very emotional?
It was. As a West Ham fan, it was incredibly emotional. It was basically him saying that he's got one more season left at West Ham and then he might look at new avenues. I mean, it was hinting a little bit towards a coaching role. I think he'll be at West Ham. It'll be his last footballing season. But
okay.
I think it's sad we haven't got many more one club men, isn't it? He's sort of going out the game a little bit.
It has. And I think that's to the detriment sometimes of the football clubs, because I think one of the big things about football clubs is the connection between fans and players, and that was always quite a big thing back in our day at Southampton. You know, we were very much a part of the community, and we were very much out in the community a heck of a lot doing stuff outside of football. Yeah. And I think that is one of the greatest things about community football clubs is that you have that connection to players. So when you just get players that come in for one or two seasons and they're off again, you know, the one of the reasons I think we stayed in the Premier League throughout the 90s, despite having probably the lowest budget in the league and the smallest crowds in the league, was the fact that we had a core of players who had been at the club a long time and who had a real affection for their football club, you know, and had a real loyalty to their football club and would fight and give everything they had for that football club. And that is really what fans kind of love to see in players. You know, I mean, we all showed it in different ways. I mean, Franny Benali showed his commitment to Southampton Football Club in a very different way to what I did on a football pitch. But nonetheless, you know, we both had the best interests of our football club at heart, and we put that before our own personal interests.
It's true what you say about community football, though. Like, my mum worked in Alderhay Children's Hospital for many, many years. And on Christmas morning, the Liverpool football team used to come around and see the kids. And to Liverpool's credit, they still do it. They just don't do it Christmas Day. They do it probably the week before Christmas.
Sure.
But mum said it was just the best thing ever, because obviously being in Alderhay, you had a mix of Everton and Liverpool, and you had kids who really were like, wow, like professional footballers, but when, because being not Everton supporters, they were like, please don't sign anything, please don't take my picture, please.
I can understand that. Yeah, we had the same thing. We always used to, Chris went around the Southampton General Hospital, but they weren't all Southampton fans and they weren't also keen to see us.
We've had a couple of people come in and said, Michael Brown's come in and said, how did you find it going from playing to going to work in the media?
That's a good question. I didn't really find it too difficult, to be honest. I was never really that uncomfortable in front of cameras, doing after-match interviews and that kind of stuff. I was never really fazed by that. So that kind of stood me in good stead for when I got thrown onto television after my career. In fact, I think I did my first midweek soccer special before I retired. I was still playing. I had a few months left in my contract at Southampton. And I did my first one there, and Sky came to me and asked me. So I didn't kind of go looking for it. I've been really lucky in my life, really, is that I've never had to go kind of actively looking for a job. You know, people have kind of come to me and asked me to do stuff, and it's been quite nice. Up until I'm 52 and now looking for a new job. but yeah, I didn't find the transition too difficult at all, if I'm honest. And I did I worked a little bit for the BBC and a bit for ITV. And then I think it was about two and a half years after I retired, was when Rodney Marsh got sacked on Sky for an inappropriate joke live on television. And then Sky came to me and said, can you do every Saturday? And it was quite funny. So that was in, I think it was in the January. And they said, can you do every Saturday till the end of the season? And I was like, yeah, no problem. I can do that. I mean, I was dossing around playing golf, really. You know what I mean? So I went, yeah, that's fine. And so I did every show until the end of the season. So I just got paid per show. So I didn't have a contract or anything. And then at the start of the next season, just before the start of the following season, I had a message from Sky saying they want to give me a contract. Right, so they were going to give me a 1-year contract to do the Soccer Saturday show. And so I was like, well, you know, I was doing this other work for other people as well. So I was freelance, and it would have meant that I wouldn't have been able to do any work for anyone else. So so I just wrote back and just said, I tell you what, make it 2 years and I'll sign it. You know, the money was fine. So I said, just make it two-year contract and I'll do it. You know, 1 year is neither here nor there. And so I sent that message back, and then I never heard anything for about 6 weeks. I thought, shit, I've blown it. And then eventually, about 6 weeks later, I'd done a couple of shows I was just getting paid for. And then eventually, about 6 weeks later, I got a text message going, all right, we'll give you 2 years. The gamble paid off. And then ended up having 15 great years there. So that was, you know, happy days. I had 17 fantastic years at Southampton, 15 great years under contract at Sky. And I've been very, very lucky in my life, you know. So, I'm pretty happy.
Well, there's three questions in quick succession come in. And one of them is, how big is the rivalry between Guernsey and Jersey? Then ask Matt who he thinks is the best midfielder. And how proud and how inevitable was it that you was going to score the last goal at the Dell?
Okay, what was the first one again?
The first one.
Guernsey and Jersey.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The rivalry between Guernsey and Jersey.
The rivalry is, you know, it's pretty intense at times. I think there's been years in the past where the big Moratti game at the end of the season has, you know, been quite feisty at times. And on occasions, I think, you know, back in the bad old days when football violence was around, there had a few dust-ups, I think, along the way. But most of the time, it's a pretty friendly rivalry, most of the time. So, yeah, it's not too bad. Second question was the...
Best midfielder?
Best midfielder, whatever, or that I played against?
I'm assuming now, I would assume, in the Premier League now. It's not actually said Pacific, but I'm assuming...
Okay. At the moment, I mean, I think you've got to go a long way to be any better than Phil Foden or Jack Grealish at the minute. You know, I think the pair of them two have been pretty special in the Premier League this season. I think the future and the chances in the Euros in the summer are pretty good if we can keep all our most talented players fit.
And it seems to be a lot of youngsters coming through though, Matt. Do you think that with those two, and then you've got the two at Arsenal, Saka and Smith Rowe, and
Doc, you mentioned Arsenal, Dave.
But there is a lot.
Bleated in swear.
Shock.
Yeah. But there is a lot of youngsters out there, and it seems to be really promising.
It does. There's some talented boys out there, and hopefully we can, you know, not turn our back on super talented footballers in this generation and try and win a tournament. You know, 1966 seems a long time ago now. We must be due one.
And who do you think is the best midfielder ever?
Blimey, I guess it depends what you kind of class as a midfielder. I mean, if you're talking about Diego Maradona as a midfielder, then playing in that number 10 role is could be classed as a midfielder. There's just been so many down here. I was a Spurs fan as a kid, so I'd be a little bit biased, and I would say, despite him not picking me for France 98, I would still say Glenn Hoddle is the most talented midfielder. I would say probably Michel Platini, of all the players that I saw, you know, were awesome. Zinedine Zidane would have to be in that conversation. So there's, you know, there's plenty to choose
from. And who you played against? Who would you say was the best you played against?
The best player I played against, I would probably say, would be between Thierry Henry and...
Did anyone tell him he's not allowed to swear on the show?
Oh, I knew it was coming. I'm sorry, Ems. I watched Kobe's one and I knew it was coming, mate. If you didn't say it, it was better that you set it up than me. Ems, you've got to let it go one day, girl. It's only one handball. It's only a little goal. It didn't cost you anything, did it? Come on.
It's called football, Ali, not handball. It's called football.
It was accidental.
It was. I agree.
Right, Matt, Leticia, our guest list forever.
Well, you're not going to do a Piers Morgan, are you? And you're going to storm off or anything, are you, girl? Come on, we're better than that here.
Are we?
Freedom, come on, freedom of speech. it would be between him and Roberto Baggio. I played against Juventus in the early 90s in a friendly. And Baggio was just pretty special footballer. So it would be between them two. Roberto Baggio.
Who was your football legend growing up? Like, who was the player you looked up to as a kid?
So Glenn Hoddle was my ultimate hero, but you can tell I'm always fairly balanced and I don't really do rivalries that much because my other hero growing up was Liam Brady, who was in the Arsenal midfield at the time and who had probably the sweetest left foot I think I've ever seen on a footballer. So those two were the two that I admired growing up and I wanted to be like, to the point where I got to a point when I was about, I think it was about 13 or 14, and I wasn't particularly great with my left foot. And but I wanted to be a bit more like Liam Brady. So I challenged myself and I challenged myself that for the next three football matches I was going to play, I wasn't allowed to touch the ball with my right foot. And I can't tell you how quickly my left foot improved just by doing that. It's a great little tip, actually, for young footballers. If they want to be better with their other foot, challenge yourself to play a football match and not touch it with your strong foot.
Not in a competitive game, though, guys. Your manager's going to be texting in going, oh, my God, what did you do?
Every manager.
It was a cup final.
Oh, yeah. Pre-season friendlies are good. Pre-season friendlies are good, but I actually did do it in competitive games because it was that easy.
You're a legend, though, mate, so I think we'll let you off for that.
Yeah, come on.
God, wasn't it?
What was that, Courtney?
Le God was your nickname.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I got in trouble for that as well. Actually, I had a load of people write into me at the Dell. Seriously, and they were asking me if I could actually go on television and tell everyone that I'm not God.
You've done it now. You've done it now.
I thought it was a little bit unnecessary. I don't think people actually thought I was God. It was just a nickname, and some people need a sense of humor.
There is a weird halo shape over your head there, Matt. So I'm...
That's my life. My daughter's like, I've nicked.
When did that name actually come from?
Where did it come from? Just a couple of fans. What happened? I think they decided to... When I went over to when I was taking corners, and I think it kind of just went from there, and somebody just had the God printed on the back of their shirt, and that was it.
So was it inevitable, though, for you to score the final goal at the Dell?
So yeah, that final goal at the Dell was pretty amazing. I thought it was inevitable because I spent the whole 5 days before the game actually just imagining what it was going to feel like when I scored that last goal at the Dell. Because I got told on the Tuesday before the game that I was going to be on the subs bench, but I would be on the pitch at the end. Stuart Gray was manager at Southampton at the time. I wasn't really fit, and that won't surprise a lot of people. And I actually hadn't scored a Premier League goal that whole season. And we come to the last game at the Dell, and he just said, look, for what you've done for the football club, when that final whistle goes on the weekend, he said, you'll be on the pitch because you deserve to after what you've done for the club. So I was like, oh, that's cool. And then from that moment on, from that Tuesday on, all I was thinking about was how I was going to score the last goal. I wanted that honour to have the last ever league goal at the Dell. And so when the ball dropped to me in the 88th minute, And it wasn't the easiest chance in the world, but I knew it didn't matter how difficult the chance was. All I needed was one chance, and I knew where it was going to finish. And when it dropped to me on the left foot, a little bit behind me, and the half volley left my boot, as soon as it left my boot, I had zero doubts where it was going, and the fact that the goalkeeper was going to get nowhere near it. And it was just the most amazing feeling I think I ever had in my career, because the noise from the stadium that day, I can still close my eyes and picture the moment and recreate that, the sound that was made in the stadium, and just the adrenaline that was going through my body when I ran off and sprinted towards the stand where my dad and my son were. And it was just an amazing, amazing moment, really. I was so chuffed, and then just after that, we actually had another attack, and Chris Marsden nearly scored. So he's had this shot. The keeper's made a great save. Manninger was in goal. He's made this great save. He's tipped it over the bar, right? And I'm on like the right hand side of the pitch, and it's gone for a corner over on the left. So I've had to run across the 18-yard box to go and take the corner. Yeah. As I was running across, I really wanted to go and give the goalie a cuddle and go thank you.
So you must have to tackle him, to be fair, yourself.
No, I shouldn't have done. So I go over to take the corner. So I go over really slowly. So I'm like walking over, I get there, and I put the ball down on the corner, and I thought, I don't want to put this in the box. Someone might head it in. So I was kind of waiting a few seconds. Then Wayne Bridge come up from the halfway line from left back, and he's coming to show himself for the short corner. So I thought, yeah, that'll do. So I just rolled it to Bridgie. And as I rolled it to Bridgie, the referee put his whistle in his mouth and blew the final whistle. I was like, that get him.
Brilliant. When you were a player, Matt, was there many females in the backroom staff, part of the backroom staff, or any, if any?
That's a good question. Not... certainly not on the coaching staff. Now, you have to remember, back in the 90s, we did not have a big staff. You know, we did not have the support staff that's available to the football clubs now. So, I mean, when I look back now, we had a manager, we had a first team coach, we had a reserve team manager, we had a youth team manager, and we had two physios. And that was it. That was our staff.
Were the physios male as well?
So the physios were male, yeah. And I think kind of towards the end of my career, a few more support staff started coming in. Most of them were men. But I remember we had a dietitian that came in and spoke to us about what we should be eating. And then couldn't believe it when I told her what I was eating.
What was the highlight, Matt, out of interest?
The highlight of what?
Your diet.
My diet? Yep. The highlight of my diet was sausage and egg muffins for breakfast.
Oh, buzzing. I had one this morning. That was delicious. Good shout.
Honestly, they're magnificent. They are magnificent, but the problem I had is I used to have two, and I used to have them on the way to training in my car.
But that was fun in pre-season.
So I used to get into training, and I'd get changed and then run out on the training pitch. And then after a few minutes, I wondered why I was feeling a bit lightheaded. And one day I was really fuzzy in my head, and I couldn't understand what was happening. And I literally had to just sit down on the pitch, and the physio came over and he went, "You're right." I went, "I don't know, I'm a bit... just a bit like Eddie, gone a bit fuzzy. You can't really..." And he went, "Well, what have you done this morning? What have you had breakfast?" And I went, "Yeah, I had breakfast." He went, "What did you have?" And I went, "Two sausage and egg McMuffins in the car on the way in." And he went, "Yeah, that'll probably do it. You don't really want to be doing..." He said, "That's not good for your blood supply." He said, "You don't want to be doing that anymore." So if I did have one, then I used to have to get up really early and like have it 3 hours before training.
They don't make them like they used to do in football.
Definitely not.
Imagine they're eating salmon stuff now, isn't it? A bit of avocado.
Yeah, I mean, my Saturday nights were, I used to look forward to my Saturday nights because obviously we'd play on a Saturday afternoon and you would just expend all the energy that you had during the football match. And so on a Saturday night, it was just like, whoa, I've just burnt off about 3,000 calories there. I'm going to put them all back. And so Saturday nights was my night to go down the fish and chip shop and just have the biggest bag of chips and battered sausages you can imagine. It was I loved Saturday night fish and chippy.
Someone's just texted me about food. I just said, where did a Greg's steak slice rank? I recall that from Harry's Heroes filming.
It wasn't a steak slice. It was a sausage, bean and cheese melt.
Oh.
So I used to, I used to eat quite a lot of them because there's a Greg's, the nearest garage to my house is like a couple of miles away and they've got a Greg's in it. It's just the worst thing ever because like every time I go and fill my car up with petrol, it's like, okay, go on, I'll just have a couple of sausage, bean and cheese melts.
That came from a guy called Tim Saul, who was actually CEO at Harlow Football Club when you were down, I think, filming.
Yes. So what they did, obviously when we started doing all the training, I stopped eating them. And so like a couple of months into the training, it never made it onto the show, this part of the filming that we did. So a little exclusive here. So they did a blind food test challenge. So they took me out to the center of the field at Harlow, and sat me in front of a table and they bought out loads of food. They blindfolded me and made me taste loads of food to see if I could taste what it was. like a Bush Tucker trial.
Yeah.
And so the last thing they bought out, now bear in mind, I've been eating like eight of them a week. The last thing they bought out was a sausage, bean and cheese melt. And I didn't know what it was. I couldn't taste what it was. But it wasn't that my taste buds had changed in the 2 months that I'd been properly training and eating properly. It was just the fact it was stone cold.
Oh,
and there's nothing worse than a stone cold sausage, bean and cheese melt. It's disgusting. And it tastes nothing like it does when it's warmed up in the microwave. Yeah. So that was my excuse.
To be fair, if that had been on TV, I'd have written into Ofcom, to be honest. That would have been a disgrace, honestly. I could see that being like a national tragedy. Honestly.
Somebody that Ali knows very well, a certain gentleman by the name of Sam Wright.
Oh, dear.
Who's actually the CEO, if I'm right, he's the CEO at Cray Wanderers.
He's the big boss.
And he's the big boss. And he's just put on here, cut out the MacDs. I need to get Letiz on Herbalife.
Oh, part. God, of course he did. Shock horror.
No.
To be fair, if you give me 50 quid, I'll wear a T-shirt for him next week, tell him.
Ask him, does wearing shoes count as good for you?
I think it does. One of your five a day, isn't it?
Agreed. Not my father put alcohol in it.
I never drank a glass of wine in my life, do you know that?
Oh, Matt.
I know, exactly. Yeah. Or
we'll have a pint of beer. We'll have a glass.
I've never had wine. I've never had a pint of lager.
It's all about a tequila, mate, for me. Go hard or go home.
Never had a pint of lager.
Never. Not one.
Someone
that's swearing. It's awful.
That's more swearing than the other player's name.
Someone's put it in, what was the best goal you ever scored?
A goal I scored at Blackburn from 35 yards against Tim Flowers. That was my favourite one.
You scored loads from quite a good range, didn't you? They just used to leave you free, and I think that was the danger when you got a bit...
Yeah, I had a period in the mid-90s where I scored a lot of good goals in a short period of time, and that was when Alan Ball was my manager. He played me in a position basically where he just let me go wherever I wanted. And so I just used to sit myself on the edge of the box and just wait for the ball to come to me. So there was quite a few nice ones in there during those mid 90s. So I think I one sad day last year when I was really bored in lockdown, I actually sat down and worked out how many goals I'd scored from inside the box and how many I'd scored from outside the box.
Do share.
So in my career, I scored 209 goals, of which 50 of them came from outside the penalty area.
Nice. Penalties, weren't they?
And 47 out of 48 penalties, yeah.
Well, that one must have got you a bit.
Penalty, Matt?
It was saved, not missed.
What was your technique when it came to penalty taking? Because obviously that's a great ratio.
There's two things I think that helped me have such a good penalty record. The first one is that I was able to side foot the ball quite powerfully. You know, so I could side foot it almost as strongly as I could strike it with my instep. And so I think that helped me. The second thing that helped me was I looked forward to taking penalties. So I enjoyed it and I wanted to be there. And I think you can tell sometimes when a player is going up to take a penalty, you can look in his eyes and you can see if he really wants to be there or not. And so those two things, and I often give out, you know, people ask me for advice on penalties. And sometimes people think I'm mad, because mostly people will say, you know, oh, when you come to penalties, whatever you do, don't change your mind. Right? But I completely disagree with that theory, because I never really made up my mind until the very last second I was about to hit the ball. And I kept an open mind about what I can do, because I would keep my eye on the goalkeeper a little bit. And if he did move a little bit too early towards my favourite corner, which is to the goalie's left, which is where I'd always start, that would be my starting point. But I always kept my mind open that if I did see him move that way a little bit too early, I can just whip my foot around the ball at the last second and pop it in the other corner. So the one that I missed, Mark Crosley just timed his little shimmy to the left quite well. So he shimmied to the left just as I kind of caught him in my eye. And so I thought, oh, he's going to my favourite corner. So I just whipped my foot around it. But he kind of shimmied to the left and then threw himself to the right. And he managed to save it. But the worst bit about it was he actually parried it straight back to me. And I think I was in such shock that I'd missed a penalty that from about 7 yards, I put it over the crossbar with my left foot. I was more embarrassed about missing the rebound than I was about missing the penalty.
You still practice penalties, because I watched an interview with Mark Noble and he said he doesn't practice penalties at all.
I would only really practice them if we hadn't had one for a long time. So, you know, it's not something that you can really kind of replicate in training, in terms of the situation, the pressure situation that you're in. But if we hadn't had a penalty for a while, I would try and replicate it a little bit in the fact that I would go and grab the youth team goalkeeper, who was not on a lot of money. And so to make sure that he was trying properly and that I concentrated, I would offer him, I'd say, I'm going to take 10 penalties against you, and for everyone you save, I'll give you a tenner, or I'll give you 20 quid. And so that made me concentrate, and it made him really try. And that's kind of important when you're practicing. So I did that on occasions when we hadn't had a penalty for a little while.
Well, someone's put on here talking about goalkeepers. Basically, what about the goal at Old Trafford?
The goal against Massimo Taibbi, I'm assuming he's talking about there.
Poor Taibbi.
That was an interesting one, yeah. I think I'd come on at half-time as a sub in that game. 5 minutes and a half-time, I get the ball 25 yards out from goal, and I thought, oh, I'll have a pop from here, and I went to strike it, and I kicked the ground before I kicked the ball, and I actually jarred my ankle, and it hurt. So as I've kicked the ground, and then kicked the ball, and it's trickling towards him, I kind of just turned away, and I was in a bit of discomfort. And as I turned away, all the Southampton fans were in like the top corner of Old Trafford over on that side, and as I turned away, I kind of saw them all start jumping up, and going like this. And I turned around to see what had happened. And the ball's in the back of the net. And I had no idea how it got there. I had to watch Match of the Day that night to find out how the ball got in the back of the net. And all I can remember is, what I remember from that is Stuart Ripley, who was in our right winger at the time, he always used to think that I was, you know, Mr. Golden Balls at Southampton. So all I can remember running up to me after the ball had gone in the back of the net. And instead of going, oh, congratulations, well done, mate, his first words to me were, that can only happen to a jammy twat like you.
Oh, dear. I'm going to ask you a mildly controversial question now, and I ask most people this question. The girls are sick of me saying this now about officials and VAR. Obviously, when you were playing, it wasn't there. Currently now, there's a lot of, again, this weekend and the last few games, been a lot of incidents again. What's your general feelings on it?
I hate it. My general feeling is I was quite a big fan of it coming in. And the reason I say that is because I felt like it was a system that would eradicate the unfairness of some of the decisions that you've got in your career. Now, there's no question in my mind that as a player of a small team, that we would not get decisions that were rightfully ours at big clubs. And I saw VAR as a way of levelling things up a little bit. However, what I didn't realise is just how useless the referees are. Even with the benefit of a replay, they're still making really bad calls. And I called actually before it actually came in, I think it was the first time I spoke to him, I mentioned it on Soccer Saturday, is that I'm convinced that the system would be a lot better if there was an ex-player in the VAR room with the referee. I really do. I think it would just bring a little bit more understanding of what's going on in the game in certain situations where the players have been there and know what they do and know all the tricks that go on. And I just think it would help the referees enormously, but I don't hold out much hope for them ever actually holding up their hands and going, please give us a little bit of help because we're actually not very good.
Yeah, I think I just find it hugely frustrating, to be honest, watching it as a fan more than anything else, that you see it, referee go over to the screen and watch it 7 times and then make a decision that you still think, ugh. You know, I think, like yourself, I'm not a fan. I thought it'd be good. It's not really, I mean, I'm a West Ham fan, so the other weekend didn't really help me with elbows flying about, but... Maybe if it'll come and help us out later in the season for us and we'll get the old Champions League in. But I just think, I mean, we spoke to Steve Bennett recently and he was saying that he found it was the application, and not the software, but actually the application of referees looking at it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's nothing wrong with the system that's in place. The offsides will always be controversial. It doesn't matter how you make up the rule. There's always going to be a moment where somebody's going to be just that little bit offside, you know, and that's whether or not you want to go, well, there should be clear daylight between the player and the two players. But even then, at some point, there's going to be a decision that's going to be like that close and people are going to go, oh, that shouldn't be offside. It's really close. So from that situation, you know, I actually agree with the way they do the offsides. But I think there are other ways that it can be improved when it comes to making decisions. I think there should be a time limit on it. You know, I think the clear and obvious bit of the, which is why it was brought in, to rectify clear and obvious errors, I think that has kind of got clouded down the line. And we're looking now to any kind of small touch to justify the referee giving a penalty. And that for me is frustrating. Referees go to the side monitor. I think it can be questionable that they're actually being shown the best angle of the incident that's just taken place. You know, I've seen, you know, you get to see the monitor and you just look at it and think, well, that's not a very good angle. We've already seen, as viewers, we've already seen a better angle of the incident, and yet they're not showing him the best angle. And then they're showing him, see, for me, I think that has to be shown in real time. I don't think you can slow it down. Because I think in slow motion, everything looks very different. And I think there's certain protocols within it that can be tweaked to make it a much better product.
Do you think as well, though, Matt, with that, I mean, I saw something on Twitter and that the other day where there was, I don't think it was in the Australian League or one of the leagues, where the actual referees are mic'd up so you can actually hear a bit like you see on the cricket, where, you know, you hear them talking to each other, backwards and forwards, about, you know, what the decision is, who it was and what was going on. And so people can actually hear that. Do you think that would actually help the situations?
100% would help the situation. I think when the referee's just stood in the middle of the pitch there and he stands there and he's listening to the bloke in his earpiece and everyone else is stood around and just waiting for the decision, I don't see why that conversation can't be on an open mic. At that point, everybody knows that there's a review going on and you can talk through the review as to what you've seen, what you think might be happening. And I think that gives clarity to the fans. And I think it does work brilliantly in cricket. You know, when they go up to the umpire and the umpire goes, well, show me the snickometer and then show me where it pitches. Is it going to hit the wickets? And they talk.
They do it in rugby as well.
Yeah, and in rugby too. I mean, I don't watch rugby. I mean, that's, you know, it's not even a round ball. Does it count as a sport? I don't know.
I would agree with you on that comment. I think we'll chalk you up. No for VAR and no for rugby.
I'm joking to all the egg chasers out there.
He's writing to Matt directly, not to Dave. It's not his fault. Dave loves rugby.
Can you send your complaints to the We Don't Give a Shit box?
Yeah. He's checked very regularly once a month.
Checked regularly, never.
I've had one question that...
Why are you ladies checking once a month? What's
that? I can't tell you that, unfortunately. Secret.
The complaints box, Matt. We're very on top of it.
Yeah. I'd be very careful when you complain in the time of that month.
I'm going to say, be very careful, guys, when you complain.
I've got one question that my father actually asked me to ask you, because if I don't ask it, I'll get absolutely pelters. But he wants to know, what was it like being around the legend in Mr. Alan Ball?
Oh, amazing, honestly. That period of my career where he was my manager was just the best 18 months of my life. Honestly, my football life was just, most of those goals that I was talking about came when Bally was my manager, and all because he had a belief in me. You know, he believed in my ability, and that was kind of just amazing for me to know as a bloke who's grown up loving football, who just, obviously I missed out on watching the 66 World Cup, but loved the history of our football and knew that he had been one of those players that had won us the World Cup. So when he's turned up at Southampton, even before he said a word, I was like, oh my God, it's Alan Ball, he's won the World Cup. Amazing. And then when we had our first training session, him and Laurie McMenemy set the team up and put me in the middle of the team and basically said to all the other players, this is your best chance, this is your best player. You know, we were in relegation trouble at the time, middle of January, I think it was, and we were, you know, a few points adrift. And he just went, this is your best player. He's your best chance of getting out of relegation. Whenever you get the ball, the first thing I want you to do is try and pass it to him. And I was like, wow, that is just my dream come true. You know, he didn't want me to do any defending. All he said was, when we're defending, all I ask of you is that when we do win the ball back, you're available to receive that ball when we get it. And that's all I ask of you. And that was just, you know, manna from heaven for me.
That's got to be a massive confidence boost for you, though.
Oh, my God. I walked off that training pitch feeling 10 feet tall. And luckily for me, you know, I mean, that kind of thing is a bit of a gamble. Because, you know, if I turn up on the Saturday when we're playing Newcastle away and I have a crap game, you know, it kind of, you know, you don't kind of get the same belief and buy-in from the players. You know, luckily, we went to Newcastle. I set the first goal up. They equalised and I scored the winner from a free kick up at the park in the 10 minutes from the end. And so it got me off to a bit of a flyer and kind of gave everybody that actually he knows what he's talking about and we're going to do this. We're going to have a go. And we ended up staying up on the last day of the season. Due to a 3-3 draw at West Ham on the last day where I scored a free kick, I scored a penalty and I set up the goal for Neil Maddison for the third one. So, it was a pretty amazing time.
We won't discuss that any further, Matt. We'll leave that one there, I think.
So, Matt, we've spoken about your highs. I mean, it's easy to get carried out with the highs of football, but was there any point in your career where you thought this is such a low point and maybe this is not for me?
I don't know if I ever thought that football wasn't ever for me. I think there were some frustrating times, certainly towards the end with injuries, kind of getting left out of the England squad under Venables and then Hoddle was kind of not nice times, but I never lost my love of football. However, towards the last couple of years, the injuries did get quite frustrating, and I kind of played less and less games as I kind of tapered down towards the end of my career, and I had to retire at 33 because of it. And those last two or three years were frustrating for me, and frustrating because I knew I had a chance to actually overtake Mick Shandon as Southampton's leading goal scorer of all time, which would have been just, you know, the most amazing thing. And I knew how many goals he'd scored. I knew I was kind of getting close. And then the last two or three years just had so many injuries that I never had a chance to kind of get near to him. I think if I'd have scored something like 9 goals a season for the last 3 seasons, I would have caught him. But because of injuries, I never got anywhere near it. And I ended up, I think I was 18 short or something. So yeah, that was frustrating.
With disappointments, though, Matt, I mean, how disappointing, how much of a sort of a shell shock was it when, you know, all of a sudden you're getting, if it was a phone call, if it was a face-to-face or whatever it was, and all of a sudden, 1 minute you're doing Soccer Saturday and the next minute they're shaking it up and you're no longer part of it. What sort of, did you ever see that coming, or was that just something that came completely out of the blue?
Not completely out of the blue. But yeah, I think it was a little bit of a surprise because it was so close to the start of this season. You know, so they didn't really give us much of a chance to get sorted out with another job. You know, everyone's kind of sorted out their lineups. So yeah, that was a little bit disappointing. But was I surprised? Probably not, because I know that everything moves on and you have your time and things get freshened up all the time, especially in television. You know, you're only ever one sentence away from getting shoved off your job. And it was a bit of a shock to start with for a couple of days. But, you know, life goes on. I had a good knock, 15 years under contract there, another couple of years before that. And, you know, I enjoyed every second of it and had a great time. But it just means it's a different chapter of my life starting, and that's how you got to look at it.
Well, if it's anything to you, it's shocking now without you guys on it. I'll be honest. I don't watch it now. I'll be honest. It just doesn't seem to have that camaraderie on there anymore that was on there when you four guys were on there. Friends having a good laugh.
I kind of understand that, but I also at the same time I feel a little bit sorry for the guys that have had to come in the time that they've come in, because it's not the same when you've got people in different studios, you know, in different rooms, and Jeff's trying to go to people in a different studio. You know, when all four of you are sat there, you know, with no screens in between each other and all that stuff, it's very easy to kind of feel the vibe between everyone and have the crack and the banter with everyone really quick. So it's not been easy for the boys to replicate that, given the circumstances that they've come in. So I think, you know, all things being equal and when all the measures are no longer in place and they're able to sit in the same studio, I think that's when you have to judge the programme.
So what was your best time on there? Have you got favourite memories of, you know, on the show?
Back in the, when was it? I think 2005, 2006. I think it was 2006-07 season in the Championship. And we had to play Sheffield United game that game to do the last day of the season, and Southampton ended up winning the game 3-2 and staying up. You know, it was touch and go whether we were going to get relegated. If we'd have drawn, I think we'd have gone down. And I think Stern John scored a couple and then got sent off. So we were playing with 10 men for the last 10 or 15 minutes, and this was just like, I was just so tense. This is my team. We could go down to League One, which, you know, I thought was just shocking and should never happen. Didn't have to wait long. And then we win this game 3-2. And at the end of the game, honestly, I'm knackered at the end of it because I was expanding all this nervous energy, just wishing that Sheffield United don't score for that last 10 minutes when we're down to 10 men. So that was a pretty memorable one. And also there was things like the FA Cup, when Barnsley beat Liverpool at Anfield, you know, my mate Brian Howard scored the winning goal up there just after the ref had, had completely bottled, and it was Martin Atkinson actually. It should have given Barnsley a penalty, and I'm going mad in the studio, going, Martin Atkinson, you've bottled it. You should have given Barnsley a penalty. And as I'm going through this rant, Brian Howard steps up and smacks it in the bottom corner with his left foot, and then I just went mad. And obviously, Tomo's face was not pretty when I'm going mad in the studio.
Moving swiftly along to the next story.
Carry on, Matt. It's a lovely story. I want to hear some more details, please.
So the next story after that is, in the next round, I get to do. In the was it the previous round? They played Havant at Waterlooville.
Ooh.
And Havant at Waterlooville went 1-0 up at Anfield. I think they ended up losing 5-2 in the end, but it was amazing stuff. And there were some fine memories of watching Liverpool struggle a little bit.
I'll link in with that and say, what's your favourite goal against Liverpool, Matt, out of interest? You got a few, mate.
I scored two really good ones against Liverpool. So one was at Anfield where Ian Dowie flicked it on and I kind of turned Mark Wright inside out and then smashed it in the bottom corner past Bruce with my left foot. And I think it was in the same season, actually, in the home game, it was Alan Ball's first game in charge. And 27 seconds in, I hit this half volley from about 25 yards, which just never got more than 2 feet off the ground and fizzed in at the near post before Bruce could even move.
Lovely. Happy birthday for next week, girl. Enjoy. That's a little present from me.
Matt, I mean, why did they, with Soccer Saturday, one of the things I used to always look forward to myself over Christmas was your Christmas specials, because they used to be literally, you know, so funny, you know, so it was almost like, I suppose, on sort of par with a Top Gear special. Do you know what I mean? It was that type of thing. Yeah. It was so good and so funny. But then all of a sudden they just stopped. Was there a reason why they stopped doing them?
Budgets. They worked. We had some great laughs doing them. We, you know, the lads coaching, you know, the when we were managers of the young kids at Eastleigh and in the tournament up in Liverpool. Was just great fun. We did one where we did a load of different challenges where we were, you know, taking penalties.
Superstars one, wasn't it?
In golf course, yeah, hitting golf balls across the pitch, and yeah, so there was some really fun times. I think they just spent a bit too much money on them.
Word on the street is, Matt, you're quite a nifty golfer.
Yeah, I'm all right at golf. I'm desperate for the courses to open. I'm counting down the days at the minute to when we can get back.
What's left? 17 days till they open?
Yeah, 17 days. So I've got 10 days to wait until we can actually make a booking. So I know what my tee time is going to be on the 29th. So just counting down the day. I got my handicap down to 3. And then last year they changed to a new handicap system, so the world handicap system came in, and they had a different way of calculating your handicaps, and because of that I got cut down to 1.4, which is a not particularly fair handicap. I don't think I'm not as consistent a golfer to be able to be playing off that lower handicap. I think 3 was about my proper level. I love my golf, and this is the longest time I've gone ever since I took the game up without playing around, and it's absolutely killing me. Luckily, my wife for Christmas bought me a 9-foot putting mat. So I've been able to practice my putting a hell of a lot whilst I've been in this lockdown.
What's your favourite golf course to play on?
I had the very lucky chance to play Augusta about three or four
years
ago. So yeah, I mean that place would take some beating. I'm not sure I could play a golf course on this planet that would make me feel the way that I felt driving into that place. That was pretty special.
Is it as special as it looks though? I mean, it's my missus. I've always tried to get my missus, because it's always around my birthday, the Masters. So I always try to, and then you look at the prices sometimes, you know, before COVID, it's like, jeez.
My favourite ground, I think my favourite away ground was probably Spurs. You know, that was my team as a boy, and obviously going to White Hart Lane was you know, pretty special for me, and I managed to score quite a few goals there as well, so that always made it quite good. But I think the other one for me was Anfield, because growing up as a kid in the 70s, you know, having been allowed to stay up late to watch sports night on a Wednesday night when Liverpool was played in the European Cup, and to watch some of those special nights and those achievements of winning the European Cups. So actually being able to stand in Anfield on a Saturday afternoon at 5 to 3 and then just see all the scarves go up and "You'll Never Walk Alone" ringing out. Mm. It was just, and people talk about the hairs on the back of your neck standing on end. That was one of those moments for me. So that was, you know, very special ground. And I scored a goal that I spoke to you about earlier, where I turned Mark Wright inside out, was at the Kop end. And it was always a proud moment when you do something at an away ground and you score a goal against a team and the home fans give you a round of applause. Mm. You know, that's always a pretty special feeling. So that was really nice.
Well, I mean, that ground, Anfield itself, though, for me, it was always a special ground, and she's not going to like me for saying it because of being an Arsenal fan in 89 and all the rest of it. But I've always, it was one of those grounds.
Before my time, David, so talk away, love.
One of those grounds that I'd always wanted to go on a tour to, and I was lucky enough, you know, a couple of years ago to go up there and go round. And it's one of those grounds that, even though it was stone empty, we just have other people walking around doing the tour as well, it just had that sort of feel to it, a bit like what you said, where, you know, the hairs stood up on your back of your neck and your arms. You're just walking out into that stadium. It's just something really, really special when you walk out into that place. The only thing that I felt bad, it was it didn't look as big as it does on the telly.
Yeah, I get that. How long ago did you go there?
Well, Klopp was there, so I think it was only 18 months ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously it's a lot bigger now than what it was when I first started playing there. So it's, you know, had a bit of a revamp there. Mm. But it's still, you know, pretty amazing place. I mean, I was lucky enough to be in the Sky studio. We played the Liverpool in the two-legged semi-final of the League Cup back in 2017, and Shane Long scored in the dying seconds to send us to Wembley, and that was just an amazing feeling. And, you know, I was kind of right on top of where the Saints fans were, and it was just to experience that at a ground like that was just a pretty special moment as well.
Anfield, I'm not being biased, but Anfield is a fantastic situation. I remember the first time I went there, I was in the Kop end. I think I was the only girl in the Kop end. And I spent the whole 90 minutes on my tiptoes. I had calves that were cramping royal style when I came out. I couldn't talk. I had sang so loud and my eyes were burning, because when I heard "You'll Never Walk Alone" at the beginning, I just sobbed. So I was a wreck coming out of it.
Absolutely.
Well, I've got somebody else has just come in about Anfield, and I mean, literally, she's my young niece, and she's a footballer herself. Who's playing for Anfield Ladies and has played for Arsenal Ladies as well, you know, girls as well. She's come in and said, "I have been to Anfield, and it was a big atmosphere when I went there, and they were playing 'You'll Never Walk Alone.' It was amazing."
Absolutely, yeah, no, it was a special place.
Someone's
What bit of advice would you give a young aspiring footballer whose dreams are to play in the Premiership, like what yours were when you were younger?
I would say, firstly, always be ready to learn, and speak to people who have been where you want to go to, and listen to what they've got to say, because I think they're full of bits of advice, because they've been there and they've done it, and they can give you little snippets that will help. And I think for me, if any aspiring footballer, I think that the way to make the game easy for yourself is to make sure that your first touch is as good as it can possibly be. So I spend hours and hours and hours as a kid, sometimes on my own, sometimes with a big ball, sometimes with a tennis ball, just mastering the art of controlling the football. And, you know, and all you need is a wall and a ball. You know, you just test yourself. You know, you'll be passing against a wall, but you can hit it a lot harder. You can make sure you use both feet. And so if when a ball is coming to you on a football pitch, you can use your first touch. Now, I didn't have great pace, so I had to make space for myself in a different way. And the way that I did that is that I had a first touch where I had pretty good spatial awareness, and I knew when the ball came to me, I knew where I needed to put the ball to give me the most amount of thinking time to know what I was going to do with it, to know where I was going to pass it, to see what I was going to do, if I was going to take somebody on. And all that became easier because my first touch was so good. And so the best bit of advice I'll give to a footballer is work on your first touch. Everything else after that becomes a lot easier on a football pitch.
Well, so at the sportsman's dinner, you told a really, really funny story about a lady and a miss misinterpreting who you looked like. Please tell that story because it still tickles me now.
So I was taken, because people often say, what's it like living in the public eye? And most of the time it's brilliant, but sometimes it's not so brilliant. And I had one of those occasions just after I retired. I was taking a young lady out for lunch. This was in between my two marriages, just in case anyone's listening. The wife might be listening.
You know your marriage voice.
So I was taking a young lady out for lunch in a pub in Southampton, of all places. And so I walk up to the bar, ordered a couple of drinks, and the barman started looking at me a little bit funny. And so I thought, oh, here we go. I just retired at this point. And so he brought the drinks back, and he went, I recognise you from somewhere. And I thought to myself, I've just played football in your city for the last 16 freaking years, mate. You know what I mean? But you can't say anything in situations like that. So I just stood there and I went, all right. And he went, yeah. He said, don't tell me. So I said, okay. So I paid him for my drinks. As he's coming back with my change, the penny finally dropped. And he come back and he went, I've got it. He said, you were a sportsman, weren't you? And I went, yeah, kind of. And he went, you played for England, didn't you? And I looked at the young lady. I went, yeah, I did actually. And he went, I knew it. Phil Tufnell. All the places in the world where I shouldn't get mistaken for Phil Tufnell should not be in a pub in Southampton, seriously.
Oh dear. So someone's just come in and said they've been looking at Wikipedia and basically wanted to know what it was like to actually put on the Guernsey shirt and play for Guernsey.
That's one of the things that is accurate on Wikipedia. There's a lot of shit there, isn't there? So I did at the age of 44, I think I was. So what happened is that there had been a really bad winter. Guernsey had a lot of games called off over the winter, waterlogged pitches and everything. It was a really bad time. Teams couldn't get across to play their games on the island. And they had to play, I think I'm right in saying, they had to play 18 games. You physios are going to love this. They had to play 18 games in 31 days.
That sounds about right.
To finish the season, it was just mental what they had to do, and so obviously they picked up a few injuries, and on a couple of and one of the away games, they could barely muster a team to come across and play. So my brother had kind of preempted it a few months earlier. He just said we might be struggling towards the end of the season to get all these games, and he said, "Can I register you as a player?" And I was training to run a half marathon. I did my first half marathon that summer. And so I'd done a lot of training for the half marathon. I'd lost about 2 stone doing this training. And so I ended up going and playing in one of the games. I was substitute in one of the games, and I came on for about, I don't know, it was about 10 or 15 minutes at the end. But we got to get
And I'm all right.
It was fantastic. It was a lovely feeling to pull on the Guernsey shirt again. You know, I was 16 the last time I'd represented my island, so that was pretty special. So yeah, I loved it.
And that was the season they got promoted as well, if I remember right.
They ended up getting promoted. Yeah, incredible. I think they had to win the last two games of the season, which they played on a Saturday and a Monday, and they won both the games and got promoted. Yeah.
When we spoke, I think before on the other show by phone, we spoke about one of the players who I think I've got a lot of time for in the Eastmead League. I must admit, in Ross Allen. I mean, tell people about Ross. I mean, because I mean, I think if you remember rightly, you were saying to me that he could play sort of Div 1, something like that, sort of say that stage.
Yeah.
I mean, he then went off to New Zealand and has come back. Is he as good as everybody from the outside seems to think he is?
I certainly think, you know, 5 years ago, I stand by what I said. I think he was more than capable of playing at that level of football. You know, he wasn't lightning quick, but you give him half a chance in the penalty area, and he was, you know, he was pretty prolific. You know, and he what he did very well is he had a lovely turn of foot in terms of it'll make you think that he was going to shoot. He feints and dummies people really well, and he just knew where the goal was, and it's a priceless commodity. And the amount of goals that he scored for Guernsey in the first few seasons was, you know, nothing short of incredible. And he really gave the club the real kickstart that it needed when it first started. And fair play, he went out to New Zealand and, you know, played to a decent standard out there and ended up, I think he played in the World Club Championship. So, you know, I think that he was a very good... By the way, his dad was a very good footballer as well. You know, he was just a bit older than me. And I can remember Craig back in the day, and I think he made a bit of a career playing indoor football in America. You know, so he comes from a good footballing family as well.
I've just had a text message come up. It was somebody, Dad. He said, "Did you ask Matt the question?"
Tell your dad to tune in, thanks.
But listen, Matt, the time's flown by. We really appreciate
you. Hang on, before we go. While Matt is on, I want to congratulate Danny on his promotion and work this week, because there's such bad news around at the moment that, well done, Danny. Congratulations.
Well done, Danny.
But in all fairness, it's been fantastic speaking to one of my heroes, and I must admit, and it's been fantastic. And hopefully, we can do it again on you know, in future months that go by. But massive thank you to Matt, and of course also to Courtney, to Ali, and to Emily down the bottom. And must be one of the first weeks she ain't swore as well, which is a bonus. But there we go. But on Monday, me and Keith will be back for the DNK Repost Non-League Show, and we're going to do a Brentford to Non-League special. We've got Glenn Paul going to join us, Sam Saunders is going to join us, and Charlie McDonald will join us as well. And hopefully somebody from Brentford might join us as well, but we will get to see that at a later date. But a massive thank you to Matt, and of course it's Bill next week, isn't it, Ali?
It's the amazing non-league legend. He puts the elite in non-elite, this gentleman. It is the amazing Bill Lepage coming to join us, who is one of my favourite people in the world, and I am It's a little birthday present to me and Ems for next week. So can't wait to have Bill on. Please tune in. And over to you again, David.
That's great stuff. Thanks, mate. And we'll see everybody next week. Until then, good night.